Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. Today we're here for a special edition of the Backstage series from the annual meetings of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Rebecca Christie, speaking here with Nicolas Véran, a senior fellow at Bruegel, and we've just finished a panel on the future of the European financial services architecture. The panel was held under the Chatham House rules, so we can't tell you who said what, but we can talk to you about the substance of the panel and the major takeaways. Nicolas, what do you think were the key concepts of today's panel for the people who couldn't make it?
I think, the main takeaway is that after 12 years since the start of the financial crisis in mid-2007, there are still so many moving parts. This is a very complex landscape. We have reforms that were initiated, if you remember that, by the G20 in 2008, 2009, as an immediate reaction to Lehman Brothers and AIG and the international financial crisis at that time. Then we had the protracted process of international rulemaking, particularly at the Basel Committee, so the so-called Basel III Accord on a number of things that constrain banks. Then we had the Eurozone crisis, and from that came the banking union, and the banking union has been a major shift in the financial sector architecture in the Eurozone, but it's still very much unfinished business. We have a functional single supervisory mechanism. We have a single resolution mechanism, which we're not sure it's really functional. And we have a lot of known missing pieces, like, for example, a European deposit insurance. And as a consequence, we still have a lot of fragmentation of the banking space inside the Eurozone. And then we have other stuff that comes along. We have negative rates monetary policy, and that affects the bank's business model. We have innovation in the financial technology space, fintech startup, big tech companies like Apple or Google that are thinking of going into finance. And if you look at China, for example, you can see that becoming a reality. So there are so many different moving parts, and it's difficult to get the big picture. What we try to do in this panel is to get some sense of priorities, and especially in terms of policies for the next commission. I'm not sure we succeeded, but we had, I think, a number of very interesting tidbits for further thinking.
I thought the debate was very interesting on whether you move in sequence with priorities in terms of the things needed to complete the banking union and the capital markets union, or whether you proceed with this idea that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed and plan your strategy accordingly to get a big deal. How would you describe the different, I won't say sides, but the different viewpoints of the state of play on that? And also, where do you think we need to be going?
Okay, yes, I think that's probably the most interesting question that comes from our discussion indeed. And we could see that there was no consensus whatsoever on the questions you're asking. So do we need capital markets union for banking union, or do we need banking union for capital markets union, or do we need to pursue them in parallel? Frankly, I think opinions are all over the place on this. The safe asset discussion, I think, is quite important. What do we mean when we say a safe asset? Is this needed for capital markets union? Because as one of the contributors said, you need a baseline, a reference point that everybody has in mind, a bit like treasury bills or treasury bonds in the U.S. Or is that something too close to fiscal union? It's only for the long term. So there are things that are more urgent and more realistic before that. Even if you take, as I would, a relatively restricted view of what can be done in the near future, and that's all about completing the banking union, so things about the European deposit insurance, dealing with concentrated sovereign exposure, fixing the framework for closing a bank that has become non-viable, and putting an end to the ring fencing, the fragmenting of the capital and liquidity of cross-border banking groups within the Eurozone. So even if you take that restricted agenda without fiscal union, without safe assets, leaving capital markets union for the long term, even there you have a question about priorities. My own view is that it has to be a package, because indeed if you make it a sequence, you have a series of bottlenecks where you cannot have general agreement. So for example, to make it a bit more simplistic than the reality. The South wants deposit insurance but doesn't want to do much about concentrated sovereign exposures. The North wants to do something about sovereign exposures but doesn't want deposit insurance. It's actually less disparate than that. But there is a bit of that. So if you say I do sovereign exposures first or I do deposit insurance first, you only get deadlock. If you bring them together, you can have a deal. But not everybody agrees on the logical connections between these points. So, for example, can you put an end to ring fencing without a common deposit insurance? One contributor suggested so, but then the question becomes, if you have national deposit insurance, isn't that a recipe for ring fencing because a national authority will say, I have to protect the national deposits, which I think we've seen in a number of member states, as this same contributor acknowledged later in the discussion. So you have all these interconnections, and I think evidently there are political bottlenecks, and at the end of the day, it will be a political decision. But just the analytical debate, thinking about the interlinkages, thinking about the interdependencies, I think it's still a bit of a work in progress, and we had a sense of that unfinished analytical, you know, laying the ground in our discussion.
Several of the contributors also made passing references to the legal frameworks in the different European countries and the obstacle that puts to a real financial market union on either the banking or the capital market side. At the same time, there's also been a sense of fatalism, not just on the panel, but in the policy space, because financial market regulators don't have much control over court systems and don't have much control at all over local dispute resolution and bankruptcy proceedings. This can have huge impacts for banks that think they've signed a contract that has collateral for some loan that they've made and then find out that they can't actually get it. Is there any reason to be optimistic that this could be resolved, or is this an unfortunate consequence of the European model that we have to work around? How do you see this unfolding?
I think the years of crisis have been educational for everybody. So if there was a view among bankers, among investors before the crisis that you can invest in Cyprus and Italy and Finland and Ireland and have the same way of thinking about collateral, I think this view is no longer there. So in a way, the crisis has had a positive side effect in terms of educating the marketplace about those differences. It's clear that if you want a completely integrated single market for financial services, you have to iron out those differences. Interestingly, they haven't been completely ironed out even in the US. If you think of mortgages and the recourse that can be claimed if there is a default in a mortgage, they're not identical in all states in the US. So the differences are not as large as the corresponding differences among EU member states, but they exist. So I think this issue can be exaggerated. I think from the treaty, the single market vision is one when those differences are gradually eliminated or approximated out. But it remains a long-term vision, and I don't think that dooms the entire reform program. I think there is some things that we didn't discuss in depth in the panel, but which is actually quite important, a distinction between two objectives, one more long-term, one more realistic in the short, medium term. One long-term objective is to say, okay, financial conditions should be the same, irrespective of where you are in the EU or even in the Eurozone. And that's very ambitious because you have all these structural differences, not just law or taxation or customs or, in the sense of, habits and lots of structural stuff. Now, there is a more modest objective, which is specifically what you need to complete the banking union if by completing the banking union, as I would, you mean breaking the bank's sovereign vicious circle. And that means that the financial conditions will continue to be different from one member state to another, but at least they're decorrelated from sovereign creditworthiness. So you don't have the sovereign credit as measured, for example, by ratings or spreads, and the credit of banks moving in lockstep. So if you can cut that linkage, even if you have a lot of differences among member states on structural stuff, then you will have made a huge step towards a functional financial system.
And one of the ways to do that might be to create a more egalitarian deposit insurance so that from a depositor perspective, a euro is a euro and you don't have to worry about what country it's in. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. I'm among those who think that the deposit insurance issue is foundational for the completion of the banking union. It's also politically very difficult. It's a necessary, not a sufficient issue to complete the banking union. But in a way, it's the core question, because as you very rightly said, this is really about what is a euro for the common person, and is money in the bank safe? Now, it is true, and that was mentioned in our conversation, that this notion that deposits are something more sacred, if you will, than just, you know, putting money to work and having savings and investment products that in which you carry some risk of losing money. This distinction between deposits and savings is much clearer at this point in the US public than it is generally in the European public. And a number, and this is understandable from a political economy perspective, because it has been in the interest of banks to blur the distinction. It has been in the interest of banks to sell to their customers savings products, investment products, which were not guaranteed, but tell them this is basically as safe as a deposit. And there was not enough of a legal framework to prevent them from doing that. So I think there is an aspect of long-term financial education of the whole European public about what is a deposit and why is it different from an investment in which you seek a better return, but you take a risk. And that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get an agreement on deposit insurance. The Italian stories about self-dealing by banks are very illustrative of what I'm talking about on a massive and frankly very scandalous scale, aided and abetted by the public authorities at the time, for which, in my view, there hasn't been enough public accountability. I'm cautiously optimistic that a deal can be made on European deposit insurance, but I think this kind of distinction shows how ambitious and how radical an idea it is.
Right. And we saw one of the contributors talk about the need for cultural norms to shift in terms of how people view the banks and how people view the markets. And part of this is knowing whether you're investing in a market investment or whether you're putting a deposit in the bank. And part of this is becoming comfortable with how markets function. If investors don't trust markets, they'll just sit on their piles of cash, even in negative interest rate territory, and that won't necessarily lead to the type of integrated market that we want. One thing that came up was one of the contributors suggested that bank profitability should be a key regulator concern, and even went so far as to suggest that the regulators, the authorities, and the central banks could require banks to reduce the ratio of their costs to their revenues. What that contributor didn't talk about is this usually means eliminating jobs, because jobs are where a lot of people keep their costs. So I'm wondering about that. But more broadly, is this something regulators would have any role in? The idea was that non-performing loans have been reduced due to regulator pressure, so you could just as easily require lower cost to revenues, but I'm not sure I see how that could work.
I think it's apt to think that regulators can only keep, I mean, the key instrument of the European Central Bank as an authority with oversight of the banking sector is that it's a licensing authority. So the European Central Bank is the only authority, even for the smallest banks in the Eurozone, even for your German local saving bank, which grants that bank a license. It actually technically took over the licenses on November 4, 2014 that had been granted in the past. But now the ECB is the only guardian of the license, and that's its primary responsibility. If a bank is not viable, it should make itself viable or lose its license.
So is profitability a measure of viability?
So it's not that simple. But profitability certainly is part of the assessment of viability. That is at the core of the ECB's task of guardian of the license. And therefore, I think that the ECB has to form an opinion, as any license-granting authority or chartering authority, as it's called in the United States, should, on whether the banks has a long-term future and is a good place for people to put their money in. So that's app. Now, how granular that assessment should be and how specific and directional the ECB guidance should be, should it go as far as setting quantitative targets for cost-to-revenue ratios? I don't think so. And as one contributor rightly pointed out, bank business models are too diverse for there to be a general target in terms of cost-to-revenue ratio. But I think it is already happening. I mean, the ECB is looking at bank business models. It's looking at viability. We can discuss whether it's too harsh or not harsh enough in terms of assessing what it takes to keep the license. But that conversation is going on.
And it's certainly fair to say that banks need to be profitable to attract equity capital, and equity capital is the gold standard of being prepared for the next shock or the next crisis under most of these rules. One thing we touched on in the panel is fintech, and this circles back to a lot of the issues because fintech is seen as a real disruptor because, in theory, it would have lower costs than banking. As contributors also said today, we have the issue of fintech costs going up because e-banking is very difficult to do across borders. No one specifically mentioned new entrants to the market and whether they might have an easier time setting up a universal electronic banking platform than a legacy bank that already is very tailored to the market that it works in. Where do you think we're going on that? Do you see e-banking becoming an international or at least a European-wide threat to small banks in particular because they aren't able to set up interfaces in all the different local jurisdictions they'd need to scale up? Or do you think that things like deposit insurance and other sorts of local consumer protection will keep new fintech entrants on a more level playing field with the legacy banks?
So that's a very complex issue, and I should do a little bit of advertising here because I'm one of the co-authors of the next Geneva report on the global economy, the one for 2019, which will be out in a few weeks, which is exactly about this topic of the disruption of banking, or lack thereof, by fintech and big tech. So both cool startups, but also Apple, Google, Facebook entering into finance, and obviously Libra, which was mentioned in our discussion, the proposal by Facebook is a kind of wake-up call for the regulatory community, whether it happens or not, but this announcement has raised a number of fundamental questions about, you know, how to think about that disruption. I think it's fair to say we're still at very early days. So this technological disruption technology has always been there for banks. Banks have always been early adopters of new technology. You know the stories about the Rothschilds and pigeons and news from Waterloo before everybody knew and all that. So in a way, nothing new under the sun. And I think this is really where this is interesting, and it's not by coincidence that Libra came up the way it did, is that it's about the connection between banking and money. And money, there is a libertarian dream that we saw with Bitcoin of a stateless money, something that would be run by an algorithm outside of any social organizational construct for men and women to live together in organized political
deflationary harmony
communities. Bitcoin remains at the fringes of the financial system. I don't expect it to become the core of the financial system. And when it comes to Libra, which is a different concept, it's a stable coin, and with a lot of rhetoric about poor countries with difficulties for financial system access and all that, it remains about money, and money is something that governments and states and politicians will keep a handle on because this is very connected with ultimately how we organize ourselves collectively and how power is organized in especially developed societies. So I think there is a technology, there is a social and political organization issues. At the end of the day, this idea that people put their money in a bank, the bank intermediates the money into, fostering economic activity, at least when rates are positive, but that's a slightly separate discussion. Even so, there are connections. And banks are agents of the government in terms of protecting the money of individual peoples, but at the same time putting it to work in the economy. I don't see this general framework being fundamentally disrupted. So banks will continue to be there. Banks will be banks. They will take different forms. There will be new entrants. There will be people exiting the market. But at this point, I don't think the fintech, big tech discussion has fundamentally changed that equation, that banks are operating under a public license to perform certainly a business function with the aim of being profitable, but also a public function of intermediating the flow of money into the economy. So even with the new technology, my expectation, at least in the near future, is that will remain the case.
You mentioned at the end of the panel that we didn't get around to discussing anti-money laundering, which is a big issue for the EU financial architecture. Can you just briefly touch on why this is such a systemic question and what might be able to be done about it?
We can debate how systemic it is for the European financial system. I think it's actually quite important, but I think in a broader sense, it has become obviously a security issue for the EU. And not being able to enforce its properly enforce its anti-money laundering legislation is a major challenge for the European Union, given its current geopolitical and neighborhood environment. And obviously, there are lots of issues among about flows coming from Russia or the former Soviet Union countries, but they're not the only ones. And if Europe wants to be even half serious about its security, this is one of the areas where the EU institutions, framework, legislation can have an impact. And there was a big wake-up call in 2018, of course, with a string of scandals. You read in the press what happened to ABLV in Latvia, Danske Bank, ING, Swedbank. Lots of these things are still a work in progress. We don't know all the details. But we know that there have been system failures in the anti-money laundering AML supervisory framework. Now, the good news is that this is an area where reform is certainly possible and where there are actually some fixes. Nothing is ever easy, but some plausible, realistic, politically realistic fixes that would considerably improve the framework. Not make everything perfect, but close a lot of the loopholes. And I think this is an issue that the coming European Commission should give a very high priority to, because that would be a way of demonstrating to our citizens that on a matter that is fundamental to thinking about security, so EU can actually solve problems and make a positive difference.
I believe you have a very interesting paper on this topic available on the Bruegel website, so anyone listening who's interested in this should go track that down and read it. We covered so much ground today on this panel. Bottom line, are you optimistic about the future? Are you at peace with where we are, or are you pessimistic that things may have ground to a halt and could be putting the European economy at risk?
I'm optimistic about the next 5 years because I think the new European Commission comes with a clearer mandate than the previous ones. And of course, a lot will depend on the choice of who, for example, is the Commissioner for Financial Services, and that may have been announced at the time people will listen to this podcast, but at this time we don't know. So there are lots of uncertainties, but I think the political conditions, despite all the doom and gloom that people always mention when they discuss Europe, actually I think we have conditions for reform which are better than at any time in the last, 10, 15 years, that would get us to the aim of a complete banking union, by which, again, I mean breaking the bank sovereign vicious circle, a more credible framework for laying the ground for a capital markets union. So, for example, if you think of capital markets infrastructure and their consistent and credible supervision, the same with anti-money laundering. So I think that the European Union can afford to be much less in firefighting mode, in reactive mode, thinking more strategically about what needs to be reformed in priority. So I'm not sure I'm optimistic. I'm aware of the political difficulties, but I see a space for a significant improvement for European citizens of the financial system from its current situation. So I think this is worth spending time on.
Thank you so much, Nicolas Véran, speaking with me, Rebecca Christie. We are at Bruegel, part of the Bruegel annual meetings, and you're listening to the Backstage series in the Sound of Economics Bruegel podcast series. If you are interested in more, we have a whole podcast channel. You can find all sorts of papers and blogs on our website, bruegel.org, and we hope to see you again at future events. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.